Are model organisms still relevant to biology? How can we spot and debunk science misinformation? Should we use data on human genetics when developing social policies? Have you heard of the stealth organ that ants manipulate during development to create super soldiers? Or the single gene in a plant that alters the fate of an entire food web? Join biologists Art Wood and Marty Martin along with new co-host Cameron Gallenbore for Season 5 of Big Biology. Art, Marty and Cam talk with researchers, journalists, historians and philosophers thinking about the biggest, most groundbreaking questions in biology, ranging across fields from ecology, physiology and evolution to neuroscience and psychology. The goal is to inform and debate in a fun, casual way that's accessible to all. Subscribe to Big Biology wherever you get your podcasts, visit thebigbiology.org or follow Big Biology on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook. Hello there, and welcome to Preprints in Motion, a podcast taking a deep dive in the fast-paced world of preprints.
Join us as we sit down with early career researchers, discuss their latest preprint, and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia.
Hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, and find us on Twitter at MotionPod. Support us by heading over to buymeacoffee.com/preprints. But for now, let's get into the show.
Hold on to your seats for the beginning this week. We talk synthetic carbon fixation, climate change, having a lab thrust upon you, and eLife's new publishing model. So very timely of us. Good starting place to start with everyone, is who are you? And could you just give us a little bit of a background as to your journey through science so far?
Hi, I'm Sebastian. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Molecular Plant Physiology in Golm, which is located close to Berlin in Germany. And there I'm working in the systems and synthetic metabolism group, where we try to implement new to nature metabolic pathways, mostly in bacteria. And I got there 5 years ago when I started my PhD in the group of Dr. Aaron Baevan, who was a junior research group leader at the time. And I did my PhD with Aaron, which was a very exciting experience. Aaron was a very shiny and special and brilliant personality. So I really learned a lot from him and from the group. And as I did so, and I was not done learning and I was not done working on the projects I was working on in my PhD, I decided to stay with him as a postdoc. Unfortunately, shortly after I graduated with my PhD and I was just about to start into the new postdoc project, Aaron suddenly passed away, which was a big shock to all of the group members. At the time, there were 7 active PhD students who had lost their supervisor from one day to another. And that was a big drama, which continues to exist, but I think the chaos has a little bit disappeared by now. So we managed to keep the group alive as a mostly democratic project in the beginning. And now it's just me and a few people left. So currently I'm actually leading the rest of the group. And we are hurrying to finish some of the projects we started before the group ends, actually, in summer next year. So the group is doomed to end. But it was a really cool journey, and I'm happy to talk a little bit more about this.
I mean, we will definitely circle back around to that. That's, not what I was about. I thought you were about to say then a pandemic happened.
Yeah, actually, like the pandemic was not hitting us too hard, in a sense that the Max Planck Institute remained open throughout the pandemic. So there was no time when the institute was closed. There were times when there were restrictions, there were times when we needed to be limited number of people in a certain room, and there were precautions taken, but the institute was open really all the time. And also in Germany, as you may know, the lockdowns were not as strict as in other countries. So the lockdown didn't, so there was, it was more Aaron's death, which hit us much more than the pandemic, to be honest, like on a personal level.
Yeah, I imagine it would. One of my advisors during my PhD died in the final year, and it was, you never really think what happens to a lab when the PI dies suddenly. They tend to either, they wrap up naturally because the PI retires.
Yeah, also if the PI retires, I mean, then usually he or she tends to prepare or like, I don't know, guide the people to maybe the next position, or maybe even find like a predecessor.
Yeah.
Like the next one. Yeah. Yeah. If it comes to that sudden, that's of course, and there's no, I mean, we learned this, that there's no protocol in place. And of course, maybe there should not be a protocol in place now, because it's not something which we expect to happen. Yeah. But that was a bit, my past 5 years.
Well, we have never opened a show like that. There's a first one for us.
Wait, we can also change it if you want. Like, if this is too dramatic, we can. I could skip that fact.
I think it's a really good talking point. Actually, I think we will come back to that and how you find that process. But let's do science. Let's have some order to this. So I've spent quite a long time trying to find a good synthetic biology type preprint to talk about, because a lot of them are either too technical for what we try to do here, or I just don't understand it. And so I wouldn't be very good at facilitating conversation. But this one was, the thing that really stood out was actually how you did it, which is, I think we'll get to. But we're talking about carbon cycles, and this definitely for me is something I haven't done for over 10 years. So I guess a good starting point would be, could you just refresh all of our knowledge on what the carbon cycle is?
Well, I try my best, because as you know, we are working on synthetic processes. So also the carbon cycle to me means the cycling of CO2, which there is in the atmosphere, and then, well, fixing it, which happens mainly by plants, but also by some microbes. So having carbon fixed on the biosphere on Earth, and then it's being used by living organisms. So it's released again, so you have a cycle. This is my basic understanding of the carbon cycle. And of course, if everything is in balance, then you have a net zero reaction, where basically every CO2 which is released is at some point also fixed, which is not happening, as we all know, because there's like a big surplus of CO2 on our human bank account. So that's the area we are working on, is basically how to get rid of this surplus CO2 in the atmosphere. And, you know, there's many people working on this, and I think that's the way it should be. Yeah, like, we need to tackle the problem from all sides possible. And the way we look at it is that we aim to engineer microbes with natural but also with synthetic metabolic pathways. These can be linear pathways or cycles, as in the publication we're talking about, to actually grow on CO2 or CO2 derived one carbon compounds. Yeah, so the group my PhD supervisor and boss Aaron Barevan was doing his PhD in is the Milo lab at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel. And they're actually the first group to engineer the Kelvin-Benson-Wessom cycle in E. coli. So I think this work, well, is earlier than, is definitely earlier than our work, and maybe also inspired Aaron to think of the novel pathways he then later on designed. So they took the natural Kelvin cycle, which exists in plants and also in some microbes, but they transplanted it into this work host bacterium E. coli, Escherichia coli. First of all, to demonstrate that it's possible, but with the long-term goal, of course, to use CO2 as a feedstock for biotechnological productions. And, well, CO2 is nice, but it's also like a gaseous compound. Yeah, you have to basically do the cultivation, somehow get the gas in there, and you might have to use high CO2 concentrations. And, well, this is why Aaron said, okay, maybe we can work with a different compound which is CO2 derived, and in our case it's formate or formic acid, which can be relatively efficiently produced from CO2. So this there's different chemical methods available to reduce CO2 to formate. The most prominent, or the one we advertise the most, is electrochemical reduction, where you use electrical energy, a catalyst, and then I think water is involved in the reaction to reduce CO2 to formic acid. This is basically not our business, but it's of course required for the concept of our work. So then the CO2, which has been reduced to formate, can be, the formate then can be used to feed microbes, and formate is a natural substrate for some microbes, which use the serine cycle. And I think also the reductive acetyl-CoA pathway. But we want to go one step further. We want to use synthetic pathways, which are optimized for engineering in biotechnological relevant microbes. So Aaron looked at metabolism, and I think he must have looked at it quite a bit because he knew metabolism really by heart. Yeah, all the reactions there is. I think he was like a living database. And he also tried, and I think he understood the logic behind metabolic reactions and metabolic networks. And based on this vast knowledge and databases which are out there and like accumulated knowledge, he designed novel pathways that can allow formate assimilation in microbes, and then he came to Germany with his PI position and was able to realize all of these pathways which he kind of theoretically designed and calculated through. And then basically with the help of us, the scientists who were working in the lab, we could show that by now two of these pathways are active and allow growth of E. coli. So it's a little bit of a longer procedure, of course, how to get these pathways into E. coli. But so we have now made the proof of principle that basically this renewably produced formate, which is derived from CO2, can support growth of Escherichia coli and also other microbes.
In the preprint, the thing I really liked is that it's very modular and you kind of build it up bit by bit, which is a very methodical manner of doing things. So could you just walk us through that building up part and why you chose to do it that way?
Sure. So that's the missing bit, I think, to understand what was done. So, I mean, you see it in the preprint and you also see it in other papers we wrote, that, and you said it just now, that we use a modular approach to metabolic engineering. And whereas in classical metabolic engineering, you would just overexpress something and then maybe by analytical methods see if these enzymes are active. For example, if you want to produce a compound and then you overexpress something and you see if this compound is there or more of this compound is there, which often has very laborious screening involved. We use a method called growth-coupled design or growth-coupled selection, where we couple the growth of a cell to the pathway activity. So this is the first thing to know. So we kind of make designer strains, which we call selection strains, that cannot grow anymore the way they naturally do. But they're designed in a way that they can only grow if the novel pathway is active. So in theory, you could say, okay, we take the complete novel pathway, in this case, the serine-threonine cycle, and we just like design a strain which cannot grow unless the full cycle is active. This might sound like a good idea, but you have to ask the question, what happens if you do overexpress all of these enzymes? Yeah, it's quite a long pathway. The strain cannot grow if the pathway is not active. You overexpress this and the strain cannot grow. Where do you start troubleshooting? So as this, is kind of impossible because then you have 10 enzymes and you don't know which of them is not expressed, and then you need to go into this tedious process of troubleshooting and trying to find a methodology to really find the problem. We say, okay, we divide the pathway into smaller units, which we call modules, and we first test the individual modules in dedicated selection strains. So then we say module one is format assimilation. Format in this case is assimilated into methylene THF, which actually is already like a cellular building block. So we always need to work with metabolites which are essential to the cell. If they are not, we might be able to you know, couple their presence to a reaction which makes an essential metabolite out of them. But then format is assimilated into methylene THF and attached to glycine to form serine. So the first thing we can do is we can create a strain which is serine auxotroph, and then overexpress the format assimilation enzymes and feed it on glucose, glycine, and formate. And if it grows, it means that formate assimilation is active. Yeah. And then we can do this with the different modules of the pathway. It's not always very easy. It's not always 100% straightforward. We cannot always select for just one module. Sometimes we have to combine modules, or we have to select for 1.5 modules. But like this, we can already say, okay, the enzymes we express are of these different modules are active in our different selection strains and our different assays. Let's try to combine them. And, well, if everything goes well, you combine 1 with 2, and then 1 plus 2 with number 3, and then you have the full pathway active. This was the case when we established the reductive glycine pathway, which is a linear pathway and really just has 3 modules. With the serine threonine cycle, there was more work and also quite some evolution involved to get the whole thing going. But I think the modular approach really still helped. And this design of the selection strain, which I think is the most complicated thing. And this is something Aaron was really good at. And I by now learned also quite well, I would say. I'm not definitely not there where Aaron is. That's really essential to the whole work.
So I don't know whether to ask for an overview of the serine threonine cycle now. This is one of those things where it would be really beneficial to have that map of the metabolic pathways up for somebody, which is a horrible map. It's very complicated. Could you give us a little overview of what the serine threonine cycle is normally used for?
The serine threonine cycle, which we engineered in E. coli in this preprint we're talking about, is not used by anything anywhere because it's a synthetic pathway. It's based, however, on the kind of, I call it the blueprint of the serine cycle. So the serine cycle is a metabolic pathway used by certain methylotrophs in nature to grow on methanol via formate. So they can grow on formate via this cycle. So formate is the entry point into metabolism. I do think so that most of them actually grow on methanol. So when you oxidize methanol twice, you go via formaldehyde to formate. And then you can oxidize it once more, then you are back to CO2. But so the serine cycle is used for growth of these organisms. And Aaron looked at the cycle and said, well, it's a nice cycle. We could engineer this in E. coli, of course. But he said, well, let's try to optimize it so it fits better to the endogenous metabolism of E. coli. So the metabolic network, you're right, is very complicated and very complex. But there's, quite a big difference between an organism that naturally grows on a C1 compound and E. coli. They will have many things in common, but quite some things will be different. And for example, one difference Aaron was noticing was like, okay, the last steps of the cycle, they go via Malu-CoA in the natural serine cycle, which is then cleaved to glyoxylate and I think acetaldehyde. I would have to check this. So the last reactions really of the natural serine cycle, they are problematic because they kind of counteract the natural TCA cycle of E. coli. And Aaron said, well, let's try to avoid this. We can do something like from the metabolic logic, something similar, where we go from oxaloacetate to threonine, which can be cleaved into acetyl-CoA and glycine. So even though it's a completely different route we take, we end up at the same at the same final metabolite. So this is the important difference, one of the important differences from the serine-threonine cycle to the natural serine cycle. And then also we avoid hydroxypyruvate, which is toxic. It's a toxic intermediate. And initially we had the idea, okay, that this could be problematic. Yeah. On the other hand, hydroxypyruvate is not only toxic to E. coli. I think it's also toxic to other organisms, maybe even to these organisms which naturally use the serine cycle. So, yeah, you know, the doses makes the poison, right? So if we talk about these steady state concentrations of metabolites, I think they're often very low because, you know, one hydroxypyruvate is produced and then it's directly used by the next enzyme. So the toxicity issue might not be a problem. And I think it could also be a good idea to engineer the serine cycle in E. coli. It was just that we thought of this synthetic variant, synthetic brother of the serine cycle, and decided to engineer it.
Yes, toxic metabolites was going to be one of the things I asked about, especially if you're scaling this up to the kind of scales you need it to be effective at combating climate change. That would, presumably that would change things because you're going to, the cells are still releasing some of these metabolites, right?
There's many problems associated with doing things at large scale and scaling it up to something which really produces something. So first of all, like the physiological behavior of the cells seems to be very different in very big volumes. I don't think that, for example, if the pathway has a toxic intermediate, that this will be a problem because, as I said, like the pathway, as long as the cells, as the pathway runs in a balanced way, there shouldn't be any accumulation of a metabolite. Yeah. So this is, this would, of course, be problematic if you have accumulation of an intermediate. What could really be the problem and what is a problem that needs solving, and people are working on this because, there is a company already working on, trying to, establish formatotrophic bioproduction, so to say, is that if you feed formate as a salt, so first of all, formate itself is toxic, yeah, at higher concentrations. So this is an issue. And of course, like if we compare it to glucose, no, if you have a big bioreactor and you really simplify it and you say like, okay, I open the lid and I throw in, you know, like a big bag of sugar, that's my feedstock, and then like I stir it and I wait until they start producing, well, for example, ethanol. No, that's the classical example of biotechnological production. This is something you would want to have with formate as well. No, you want the, like for industrial production, you always want the simplest, yeah, with the biggest yields. No, like no additives, no nothing. No, like just like let the microbes do everything, and they need to be very robust and deal with what we give them. Well, with formate, that's a bit different. So formate is toxic. Formate, if we feed it as a salt, will lead to change of pH during the growth. So this is something I observed in this study, firsthand. No, the serine-threonine cycle consumes quite a lot of formate. It consumes a lot of formate, which it doesn't need for growth directly. So a lot of the formate which is taken up is oxidized for the production of energy. So I think we calculated that roughly 90% of the formate are oxidized for 10% to be assimilated, which means the cell will take up quite a lot of quite many formate molecules before it can actually grow and divide. So even with little growth of the cells in these experiments we did, we saw a dramatic increase of the pH. And this is related to the formate ion, which is in the medium, because we feed formate as a salt, sodium formate, so it dissociates in liquid. And the formate ion, which is taken up by the cell, is taken up as formic acid. So for every molecule of formate which is consumed by the cell, we steal one proton from the medium and, well, deprotonate the outside of the cell, leading to this increase of pH. So these are things people need to, or process engineers, I would say, need to worry about how they can, in a continuous system, set up like a feeding system where they feed both formate and formic acid, because then you can titrate and get rid of this issue. But also the formate toxicity itself is not 100% clear, the molecular mechanism, so you cannot feed too much formate at once. So it's not the it's a rough and rocky road to go to this sustainable production. I think none of the C1's feedstocks is ideal, no? They are poor in carbon, they are poor in energy. I mean, that's the big advantage of glucose, but, well, that's where we want to find an alternative to, no? So,
I mean, I'm learning a lot about scaling up here, because this is, I know nothing about this, so this is another one of those episodes I get to learn in, which is great. So could you actually maybe talk about some of those other technologies that are used? Because I, from what I'm aware of, there are a few different approaches, right, to reducing things down to single carbons. I don't know what any of them are.
You got me on this one. So we usually take this for granted a little bit. So there is different methods to make formate, but also other reduced C1 compounds. There is the electrochemical reduction, there's hydrogenation, and then there's other methods, but I'm not an expert on this, so I cannot elucidate. I wrote it down in my PhD thesis. I read some articles, but this is really hardcore chemistry, and that's where my chemistry ends then a little bit.
It's okay. Most of the listeners are biologists, so we've already lost them on chemistry. So maybe bring it back to biology. Why did you choose to do this in E. coli? Is that just because it's so widely used, or was there a particular?
That's a very, very nice question, and it's not so. It's very easy to answer, but I don't want to choose the very easy way out. So. E. coli is very widely used, you're right on this, but I think is really widely used in academic research. So I tried to look it up, and this is very difficult to get insights because industry usually doesn't publish so much. So if you wanna get an overview of the microbes which are used for biotechnological production, and there's like, that's a really difficult search, at least for me. Maybe there's people like, sometimes, you know, when you know where to look and how to look, then it gets easy. But I tried this several times to, well, have a quick search for like, what are the biotechnological products produced by microbes? What are the microbes used for this? Like, and then maybe to get like, 40% of the glutamate are produced by C. glutamicum. This might be maybe easy to find out. But then, really to know which of these organisms are used and how widely they are used is difficult to find out. it seems though that E. coli is not the guy which is used the most. Yeah? And I think this is related to it not being super good in producing things, but I don't want to say anything wrong here because there might be people out there who might claim the something else, but I'm pretty sure E. coli is not widely used in the biotech industry. However, E. coli, as far as I can say from my experience with other microbes, is the most friendly guy and the when it comes to engineering it. Yeah, so it has been extensively researched. There's a plethora of methods out there to engineer it, to delete genes, to put things in the genome, to overexpress stuff on a plasmid. So this fact in combination with the fact that Aaron really knew E. coli metabolism the best, I would say, is the reason why we studied most of the pathways in E. coli first. And then we also we do this. So we use E. coli basically as a chassis to demonstrate the proof of principle that something is possible. And then we move on to other more biotechnological relevant organisms. But honestly speaking, for me, it's really hard to if you would give me three common microbes which are used in academic research and would ask me to rank them for their biotechnological potential, I wouldn't know. Sometimes I also feel it's a little bit of a religious thing of you believe in the microbe you work with, I think.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I hear anything sort of bacterial related, I always just go immediately to E. coli. I kind of forget other bacteria exist because it is so ingrained, at least in academia, that it's just E. coli. It's why would you use anything else?
Yeah, I mean, most of the, in the microbial field, people would start throwing stuff at you now, but because of course there is tons of other and very fascinating microbes. So I recently went to a conference in the US which was on C1 metabolism, and there you have all these weird methanogens, methanotrophs, which really live at the thermodynamic barrier of life because they almost live off air. So that's biochemically, I think, very interesting. But of course, most of the people who do not directly do research on microbes, they will definitely work with E. coli at some point because we all work with molecular cloning. No, we all have seen at least one plasmid or done whatever kind of construct. And this is, I think, mainly done in E. coli. And this is also, I think, because there are so well established protocols. No, it's just so robust. I have worked with Vibrio natrigens, for example, which was also postulated as the new workhorse for biotechnology. People said so Vibrio grows much faster than E. coli. It's the fastest growing organism. So people said let's exploit this fact and then do the cloning instead of in 2 days, in 1 day. No, I mean, how you fit this in your schedule is a different question, but so far I haven't seen this new trend coming up because when we worked with this organism, it was just, stuff was working, but it was working on 1 day and the next day it didn't work and you didn't know the reason. No, and with E. coli, I think it's proven by millions.
That is true. I would love to know why E. coli started being used in the first place, actually. It's probably a very interesting or very boring history there. So what would be needed to, other than just scaling this up, to make this into a system that could be used to help combat climate change? Or is it just a matter of scaling it up?
Scaling up is one part of it. But the question is, who has an interest in scaling it up and who has the capital to scale something up? And, without naming anyone here, it's of course clear that there need to be quite a lot of investment for this. Yeah? So first of all, to build the factories, no, for the hardware, but also maybe to have a big R&D facility to I don't know, optimize processes. And of course, you know that people are willing to invest money if they can foresee a return, no? And currently, the big problem is that you are competing with other processes which are much cheaper. So we are not at a point where glucose is super expensive, no? We are not at a point where there's like heavy taxing on CO2. So there's more needed to get our, I call it our, but like to get this system in place. So I would say it's really, yeah, I thought about it quite a lot. I think if you break it down, it's political measures, no? So if you subsidize investments in this area, no, you could kind of make laws and regulate or rules and regulations which say, okay, you want to build this factory, you have to combine it with, I don't know, this kind of renewable small scale bioreactor format bioeconomy project, no? So I don't know if you know LanzaTech. Have you heard of them?
No.
It's a company which is actually doing what we are suggesting in a different way. So they work with acetogens. So they work with natural organisms that can grow on syngas. So they can grow on carbon monoxide and hydrogen, I think. Don't ask me for the details. I'm not an expert with these guys. And they can produce acetate from it. Yeah. And the company, I don't know, it's not so old, but it's like a massive success. So they can now engineer the bacterium to produce ethanol. And they can also, I think they released like a few weeks ago, like some news that they can now even produce like a bioplastic. So they sell a technology to high emitting companies, for example, a steel mill or like a cement factory. And they say, okay, we can retrofit your company or your factory, with our bioreactor system. So then they have like the all the experts on board who can do like a simulation and a calculation. So they say like, okay, you are producing so much steel, you have such much off gas per year. With our system in place, you would produce 150 tons of ethanol per year. And then, well, the companies do their own calculation and think about the investment they need to do. But this is happening. So they have, I think, many companies which are interested because I think it's, how is it called, financially viable. And so they are doing it. They're doing it with these natural organisms, and they can do it. Well, for reducing the emission of these specific plants. But if you think of combining, of finding a system which you can combine with carbon capture and storage, for example, where you really try to reduce the atmospheric CO2, and then, for example, make formate. There, the formate bioeconomy system where we are working in could be implemented. But as I said, I think there really political measures are needed, because you see with the process LanzaTech is doing, there the company itself has an interest of reducing the emissions because they can get like a profit out of it. Yeah, so. Or one makes a big effort, I don't know, a big startup which also sells such a technology. I don't know. that's maybe more of a question for an economist.
It does seem to all come down to money.
Yeah, that's always like this.
I know. So we cover we do all the science bit, and then we like to talk a bit more about academic life. Given that we're funded to ask and talk about preprints, we ask everyone who we have on, why did you preprint this particular work? Is it something you've always done, or was this the first time?
it's not something I've always done, but it's also not that I published so much in the past. So this was really the first work where I worked on completely independently, because I was the first author, and I mean, Aaron is the last author, but there was no last author to double check, to guide the preparation of the manuscript, and well, also no one involved in the decision making. So I was really free in a sense of doing whatever I wanted, no, of submitting wherever I wanted. And over the past years, and yeah, also in recent times, in conversation with colleagues, and also when seeing like in practice from other colleagues, I see that it has become more and more common to publish preprints. Yeah, so that helped me in the decision making, as I was not, let's say, afraid of the consequences. No, I also recently, yeah, like half a year or a little longer ago, started using Twitter. And then, you know, you see the Twitter community, which I think I think it doesn't represent the whole scientific community, but it is, I think it is, I feel at least that the people there have a like avant-gardistic kind of thinking, and they're really pro open science. And I'm really completely go along with this. I'm pro preprints. Yeah, the only thing is, of course, sometimes you worry maybe a bit about the system you are in, and whether the system you are in also respects this kind of movement as much as you like it. No, so I don't know. I guess you also know this feeling that you are like, I don't know, you have your own thoughts and your own ideas on something, and they might be really like pro this against that. But then you find yourself in this system which is not as flexible and, you know, rigid. But I made the decision for the preprint because I also, I don't know, it was a very long process of writing this manuscript, no? And I really wanted to get it out, like also like out to the public, no? It was, couldn't sleep there any longer on my hard drive. That was my feeling.
Yeah, that's I like them just gone. They're out. Don't have to deal with it anymore. I think the system, as you're talking about, is probably where a lot of the eLife discourse lately has been coming from. Because eLife recently changed their system to they'll accept, well, what the editors either accept or reject a paper, and if they accept it, it's published. Without the peer reviews.
That was you confirmed what I was thinking, because initially I didn't really get, and I still don't fully get how they will put it in place. I think many people are a bit confused about this.
I think that the launch was a little confusing. Basically, the system is, the editor says yes or no. If the editor says yes, it gets published, but then it still gets sent out for peer review. When the peer reviews come back, eLife, the editor, will then kind of do like a summary. eLife do that anyway, a lot of their papers. They'll do a little summary that goes along near the top of the paper to say this is what the peer reviewers thought. So if it's a crappy bit of science and you get really bad peer reviews, it will be clear that's a crap bit of science. So I think that's my understanding of how it's
working. But then if you imagine, so I read very critical comments. There was like a relatively long thread on Twitter, where I don't know, you had like an X and a Y axis, and you had like three or like four quadrants, and
Jason,
you read it. The top right should not be filled, yeah. And that's where the eLife papers are going to be. I don't know, like maybe it's bold, but you know, maybe they try it and like after a year they say, oh well, that went all wrong, or maybe it's just an intermediate stage and it goes somewhere different. I don't really have an opinion on this. There's of course a lot of question marks coming up, no? Like what happens, like for example, if the reviewers suggest major revision, like, and then or will the editor will the reviewers then suggest any kind of revision for these kind of papers? Because it's published at one point, and will it be replaced with a revised version, or will you have like kind of the history of the paper? Because
so you can replace it. So like you can, so when the reviews come back, you can then update the paper and use that as the version of record, or you can just leave it as it is. What I suspect will happen, and this is where my thread on Twitter came from, actually, I think what will happen is you won't get reviewers who say major revisions anymore. You'll get reviewers doing what reviews are meant to be, which is this paper as a singular entity supported by its data? And that's a lot easier, that's more a yes or no with variability kind of question, which I think our current way of doing peer review is very much, I'm reviewing your paper, I would like you to do these experiments, you're going to do them or you're not going to get published unless you go elsewhere. And that's not what peer review is meant to be. Because I know people who would submit a paper and hold data back because they know that's what the reviewer will ask for. So they've already got it there. Whereas certainly with preprints, what I think is happening, kind of the data is not direct, but indirectly supports this, is that because your work is going out there to the world, you put a more finished product out, which is why I believe we don't tend to see a huge change between preprint and paper. That's what I think might happen with eLife. I don't know. But the people who are setting up, I know some of them, and it's an experiment. They're trying it. They'll listen to things that don't work. If it doesn't work, I'm sure they'll revert it. And if it does work, hopefully it'll spread.
But I really like your argument that I didn't look at it that way, on this like fundamental way of what peer review is supposed to be and what it has become. And I tend to agree with you that, I don't know, like, everybody knows that you are like afraid to get this guy or this professor to review you who's directly competing. I mean, and then they suggest an experiment which I don't know, you maybe cannot do or which will take you so long. Yeah, that's actually then I actually see it much more positive than I saw it before. Huh?
Yeah, I think that's the problem. We have become so ingrained, and we never. As scientists, we're never taught and we never step back on how the system works or the history of it. And peer review, for example, publishers, will largely tell you we've been doing it for hundreds of years. And they like to say about 350 years because that's when the Royal Society first introduced peer review as a concept. We didn't do it for that long. We've been doing it since about the 70s. So peer review is an experiment. So the thing I put out that people... Steve seemed to not know is that the DNA double helix paper, not reviewed. Okay. They submitted that paper to Nature because at the time Nature only, it was an editor decision, yes or no. And at the time, I think the turnaround was a week from submitting to being published in Nature, which is amazing. We'd love that now. Einstein, I think, only ever had one of his papers peer reviewed. He had one that he sent to a journal. They sent it out for peer review. And when he found out, he sent them an angry letter and pulled his paper and sent it elsewhere. So it's not, we haven't, peer review is an experiment. And my argument has always been the evidence is that it doesn't work, or in its current form, it doesn't work. And it's not actually as beneficial and as essential as we seem to make it out to be. The bigger problem is the career structure. And like we were saying with preprints, you can publish a preprint, but if it doesn't matter for career advancement, then nobody would do it.
Yeah.
And that's more where, that's the important part, really. That was my input on the life change.
Yeah, no, you are like, it's also like if you look at it now, like the reviewers are kind of also like gatekeepers, no? And the journals would argue, okay, they are important to ensure the quality and so on and so on. But on the other hand, of course, you have like many levels of gatekeepers, no? So the first level is maybe that you need to go through an academic education, no? So then you need to work at an academic institution, maybe not. Like at least you need to work at a kind of legitimate institution for doing your research. No, then you submit it to the journal, then the editor reads it, and then they send it to the peer reviewers. And I fully agree with you that maybe it's too much to have it. Like you could also say, okay, the journal, the redefines the function of the editor a little bit more, no? So they say like, okay,
yeah,
don't make it too easy on you. You will have to read this whole manuscript and need to then decide whether it's worth publishing or not, no? And not just read the letter of the letter to the editor and then send it out to scientists who do this for free, no? It's also, yeah, hopefully we'll see some change in the system, because I don't know if I agree with you when you said like, okay, scientists haven't thought about it. And I think scientists do think, and they are also aware, no, about the publishing system in general, no, that you have to pay tremendous fees and then you have to review all this yourself. So, but then, you know, like they, maybe like the laboratory mice, no, they are very happy in their laboratory, and then they do this extra bit, because the system is there, because maybe they don't have the time, or they don't want to allocate the time to this, well, bigger piece of work, which would actually be changing the system, right?
Yeah, when I say people don't think about it, what I mean, we all know it costs a fortune, we do everything free. What I mean by that is we rarely actively research the system of how we do science. Or, I mean, there's quite a bit of evidence out there now, actually. But we never look at that as scientists. I certainly didn't until I started doing that research. But we all complain about it. But, you know, there is evidence out there as to the fact that it's not working. And I think we could all do with a bit of looking at that and saying, okay, well then let's try something new collectively.
But is it something you when did you seem to have researched this quite a bit? It seems to me. So did you recently start doing this, or?
It's sparked up during COVID, actually, when everything, so in the UK, the lockdowns were severe enough that the labs all shut, and your choices were to work in one of the COVID labs for a bit or sit at home, not really doing anything. So I started up a project looking at how preprints had been used during COVID.
Yeah.
And part of that originally was to then look at like the quality of preprints used, and it was quite a difficult question to actually ask. So we used, basically what we did is we took all the 400 preprints published within the first 4 months of the pandemic. I think it might have been 200 pairs actually. And we compared the preprint to the published version, which is a second paper we ended up publishing out. And then since then, meta research is like, I love it. And I think about it all the time. We're now writing a literature review on the evidence around peer review, for example. Or we will be. I've got a meeting about that this week. So yeah, I think about it all the time now. It's quite fun.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
But yeah, it's. I learned a lot. I'm still learning a lot. So just cycling back to where we started, I imagine stressful. How was taking on running a lab? Because, I mean, those two papers we just talked about, I was the senior author, so I went through that whole process of submitting a paper properly for the first time. And that was stressful enough. And all I did was submit a paper. So how have you found suddenly running a lab?
Well, it was definitely bumpy, yeah. But I think it was helpful that I wasn't all on my own from the beginning. So as I said, we started this off as a, well, democratic process, so to say. We, not in the sense that we voted for someone to run the group, but basically, when Aaron died, an individual research group leader who was appointed by the Max Planck Society and not by the Institute, the position couldn't really be refilled, or he couldn't be replaced. So, but then the group could still exist without having someone in charge. So we decided first that we, as a team of postdocs, start taking over like all these administrative parts of a group leader. Yeah. So, and then over the time, the other postdocs left, and then that's how gradually more and more stuff ended up on my desk. I have to say that was still very stressful and like took a lot of work. We also needed to move our lab to a different location inside the institute in between. So that was also like, I'm also an expert in lab logistics by now. So, it was stressful, but it went surprisingly well, I have to say. So I don't know. I learned a lot of things. No, I needed to learn a lot of things, but, I can also tell you I saw it as an opportunity to develop, no, to get insight into things you normally don't get insights to. Yeah. So it opened up my eyes to the rest of the academic world, which is there. Whether I wanted to close my eyes at some point and like go back to like having like a PI who takes care of all of this and I can just focus on my research and maybe my students, of course, many times in between. No, it's like once your eyes are open, you cannot, you cannot look away. No, that's, a bit the problem. No, it was a lot of responsibility, coming towards me at quite a fast pace, but I think I'm now at a position, so basically most of the colleagues of the senior colleagues left by end of March, or all of them, so from beginning of April this year I was the only senior in the group. So that's really the point which I coin now, where I'm really independent. I was independent before, but alone, so to say, with a group of students, and this is going pretty well. I would like to keep it going, but of course there was like the final date was there since the beginning, so I cannot complain. But basically I found my way into this position. It's not 100% of a routine yet. Yeah, I mean, routine takes maybe more time, but there is a certain regularity to it, and I know how to react to certain things I have seen. You know, like if you see a problem twice, then you know how to react to it better. So it was many new things falling from the sky. Yeah, it's also, yeah, you don't expect them. Sometimes you don't expect, you wouldn't imagine that they exist. No, if like I don't know, like I could talk for hours, that would but like, you know, like all these administrative, bureaucratic, from room planning to I don't know, like and it goes also up, of course, now like to the institute's level. I started representing the group and then needed to discuss with other group leaders, with the directors, and then they talk about energy bills of the institute, something I am not interested in, but suddenly, you know, you learn about this, and you also learn about the importance, you know, especially in these times, that you know, you just learn to think on, like, I don't know, with a bigger perspective maybe, like it really went away from the project detail focused mindset to more keeping the overview, which of course was specifically difficult for me because I was still working on this preprint we had talking about. So I sometimes really felt that I have to do like a big is it called spagat in English, like when you spagat, no, how is it called when you need to open the legs 100%? In German we say spagat.
If you were to do that for a chicken, you'd spatchcock the chicken.
But it sounds better in German. No, in German we have this expression, if you really need to, like, I don't know, get hold of one thing on one side and then like also try to reach the other side. So we say like you need to do the spagat. But what I meant was that it was difficult, you know, like to keep the overview, taking care of the administrative things and still finishing experiments in the lab. Yeah, like this is really, like these days I hardly have a spare minute to go to the lab, which I have to say is something I miss. Lab time.
People underestimate that activation energy it takes to jump from something super specific and focused to something more widespread, or and then again to something that energy bills that you just couldn't care less about. And it takes just skipping between those and switching your mindset to deal with those different things. That takes a lot of energy as well.
Yeah, and also...
Because I do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and also like it's not so easy if you're... It's also then not so easy if you have switched to go back into this lab kind of thing. No, like this week I went again back to the lab to do an experiment with a student of mine, and then it's possible to do it, but then suddenly you realize, wow, that takes really a long time. No, like I mean, in the lab doing the experiment, preparing everything, takes away time from other things. But it's fun, it's cool that I can still do like really nice research. I really like kind of, oh, I'm really happy that Aaron gave this gift of very, very, very interesting projects to us. There's you know, like from one project, there's the next project popping up. So yeah, there's cool experimental data being generated still. So I hope to publish some of it soon. Let's see.
Well, it definitely sounds like it's going brilliantly, especially having a lab move in the middle. That's stressful enough on itself.
So much fun.
I think we'll stop there because we've gone over an hour. That was great. I learned a lot.
I also learned a lot. Actually, I was talking most of the time, but I mean this...
That's the aim.
You know, sometimes it's the little twist, you know, like when you said like, yeah, okay, but the history of peer review is different, and then it's like, okay, yeah, true that.
And that's the show, folks. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button to get the latest updates straight to wherever it is you're listening. Don't forget to rate us on Spotify or Apple and follow us on Twitter at MotionPod. You can find links to things we've just discussed on our website, preprintsinmotion.com. If you'd like to tell us what you think, then send an email, shout at us on Twitter, or shout at us if you see us walking down the street. This has been a JMJ production, generously supported by our friends at ASAP Bio. Until next time, have a good week.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Sure, they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.